Hey folks, so remember last week I told you guys Andrew's brand new show on A&E, Don't Trust Andrew Main, was debuting. Well, guess what? It did. And if you watched it, thank you very much, because it had a really good reaction on Twitter and everybody's really happy about it. But if you did not, because you are what they call in the industry now a cord killer, then I got good news. You can go on over to iTunes and you can download the first episode for free. That is free 99, my friends. Go ahead and check out Don't Trust Andrew Main on iTunes. The first episode right now is free. And of course, if you have cable, Monday, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, you can go ahead and check it out. And psst, that means if you're on the West Coast and you have A&E HD, and you can watch it at 7 p.m. Same thing. Anyway, let's go on the show. Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Yeah, we're back. 2 weeks in a row, back-to-back Weird Things weeks in your face, world.
And Mr. Brian Brushwood.
Not just me, but I got an appendage over here. Come here, appendage. Say hello. You got to say something. Go. Say
for audio.
Oh my God!
Brian is holding what appears to be a young girl,
and that's the last time I ever do that. Sorry.
We'd like to apologize to all of our headphone listeners.
Gentlemen, you went weird. Do you want to get this right off the bat?
Yeah, dude. No, quit wasting my time. Every second you're not telling me weird stuff is a moment I'm not weird.
I'm sorry. Did you enjoy the silence, Brian?
I did. Well, I wouldn't say enjoyed. I pensively tolerated the silence.
Did you have to let it linger?
That was the original song. Pensively tolerate the silence. Wait for words to come.
We have, I don't know how to describe it, a potentially universe-shattering piece of news.
Okay, go on.
It could be nothing. It could be something. It would be a great beginning to a story that could potentially lead to our demise.
I don't know.
This is what I like to call a first-class AAA tease right here. So, this is a lead-in.
I remember seeing this once in a, I think it was like an alternate Superman story. And I'm trying to remember the details of it, but it basically like, you know, what if like Superman had landed on like Mars or something, and it'll put him into like this, you know, Edgar Rice Burroughs, Warlord of Mars sort of situation. And then I think I've seen this before, but the idea of you have your lander sitting on a planet and its cameras fixed on something, and then you see like a shadow of something. A hint of something, not a direct thing, but you're like, what's this shadow? What are we looking at? What's going on here? Right? Because then it's the opens up the idea that we land in almost the right place, but maybe not quite what we wanted to see. Okay. So we've got Opportunity rover on Mars, and it's sitting there, and it's kind of got its camera. It's been there for like 10 years.
Oh my God. You're talking about Spirit and Opportunity. And yeah. Spirit is like totally dead at this point, right? But
Opportunity still gives us video back.
Got it.
And, you know, it is just a round the clock government employee, not giving up. It's cameras fixed there. And so here you are, you're NASA, you're some guy NASA. Every day you sort of check the little feed, like your little security camera footage to see what's up. I'm like, oh yeah. Still rock, still Mars. Okay. Day 3,422.
No.
Yep. Still rock, still nothing going on.
Okay.
Day 3,538. Still rock, still nothing. Day 3,540. Where did that come from?
So just something new shows up in the field?
As they describe it, a jelly donut-sized rock has appeared in front of the Opportunity rover on Mars.
Okay, first of all, what does that say about the folks working at NASA when the first thing you compare it to is a jelly donut?
Okay, Brian, can we cut them some slack? They've literally watched the background of a computer for the last 10 years. They don't get a little sassy with their rock description. I give them a full pass.
They're like, it's about the size of a discus or maybe a shot put, maybe two or three tennis balls.
It's about the size of two rubber duckies, regulation size, taped together.
It's like half of an Adidas shoe.
So there's this rock. It's back to the mystery rock here. Now, scientists think maybe could have been when Opportunity rover moved, it flipped over the rock and they hadn't noticed it. And they're like, oh, look, we turned that over. It could be left. It could be from a meteoric impact.
Oh, like a meteor lands behind it, throws a little bit of debris over it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess my guess is they don't have like seismic readings or anything like that on there.
I don't know.
Yeah.
So anyhow, now they're trying to figure out where this thing came from, but there's a rock. What if this rock is like, you know, what if we're dealing with an ant-sized civilization?
And they're building like a huge monument to their new god, the metal overlord that has come from beyond.
Or they're building their own space elevator.
Just really slowly. They first have to do their Tower of Babel thing.
It looks kind of like a mini Colosseum. Could be.
What if that is? It's like the metal overlord has arrived. It demands entertainment. We shall fight to the death him. Beneath right, his now, gaze.
All right, so I'm thinking about this in movie form. I'm pitching it to you guys. So obviously, our main character is the guy who's watching the feed. I'm thinking Ethan Hawke, right? And like he's been watching for years and years.
It's got to be Val Kilmer.
You think now, like current fat Val
Kilmer?
Yes,
exactly.
For sci-fi channel movie of the week, or do we want to go? Are we going like big?
This is.
I'm thinking. No. You knock this out as one of those like $10 million. You know, opens at like $70 million. Like you know, horror sci-fi. You know, kind of movies that like the Purge and stuff like that. Like we want to do a sci-fi bent on one of those kind of like. Budget thriller kind of movies, right? So you get your Ethan Hawke and he's watching, and then all of a sudden it's like first there's the rock, right? Mm-hmm. And that maybe that's the trailer, like it started with the rock. And he's like trying to tell everybody at NASA, like, there was not a rock here. And NASA's like, whatever, you're going crazy.
Just like to keep your program going.
Exactly.
It's all of a sudden he starts hearing things, and it's the civilization talking to him through the rover.
Now,
somehow.
I feel like it has to be like a psychic communication or something like only he can hear. And it's like, he keeps telling them. And then like, they're all like, you know, somebody's gone a little crazy in his cubicle.
Yes.
And
maybe it's like the feed gets jittery. So it's like this thing, but it never records.
Yeah, there you go.
Get this image through here, you know, like, you know, the Zod thing, people of Earth, you know, it's like, guys, you see this?
Right.
What's going on? Like, no, there's a rock there. There's a rock. You know, he's been staring at
it. So the key is we got to either get the civilization to Earth or him to the civilization. Right? Like, that's where the story.
No. I think this thing goes to. Okay, I think the whole first like act is this stuff, and then it just snaps to the story of just one of the individuals. Like all of a sudden, now it's Gladiator, basically.
Wait. Let me give you like a mid act thing that the game changer is.
Right.
Finally, they believe him, and they're like, "All right, well, let's take the drill to this rock." He's like, "It might be alive. We can't do that." Right.
And then
so they drill into the rock, and then like all of a sudden it's an act of war, and he's got to go to Mars and a crash program to go sue for peace.
Because NASA's like, listen, we drilled the rock. I don't see what the problem is. Right. Except And this is just a naked attempt to ring in a thinly veiled Elon Musk character into our story. It's the private guy who's like, hey, listen, I've seen, because he's like been posting on some message board, right? Like this Mars research message board that nobody cares about, that our Elon Musk character is also reading. And he's like, hey, listen, I'm willing to send you to, like, I understand where you're coming from. I believe your research. I believe that you are on to the fact that we will be destroyed by this micro civilization if we do not go make peace. I'm sending you to Mars in my rocket that I've been secretly building, aside from all this stuff that I've been publicly talking about.
Well, basically, like, my plan was to go retire on Mars. I've made no secret of my plans to retire on Mars. And you all laughed at me. What you didn't know was I was secretly building Screw You Too, the rockets.
All right. So let's take an interesting detour here, because you guys bring up a fascinating point of view thought. We've talked about before.
It's very indulgent for you to at least give us the word fascinating for our point of view.
No, I like it. So let me hear where we're going. So we've talked about before, one of the biggest threats that we have to face is the possible of a meteor taking us out, you know, the asteroid we don't see crashes into us. Imagine you're Elon Musk, all right? And you're thinking, you know, I don't know if I have a whole lot of faith in government to get their act together to save our butts if something like this happens. And you're sitting there at your office at SpaceX. You're looking at your inventory of rocket engines. You're looking at the inventory of rockets. And you're like, you know, I could build a rocket. You know, all I need is, you know, if I wanted to put a warhead on or whatever, you know, assuming some conventional way to deflect it would actually work if you got to it early on. And you have a lot of money. You're buying the James Bond, you know, Spy I Love Me car or
the Moonraker package.
You know, you've got tons of cash, right?
Yeah.
Do you like pull in a couple of your bright guys like, hey, listen, let's have our own scenario where if the asteroid comes, we solve it.
Oh, my God.
Dude.
Do you think there's some part of me that definitely believes that's already happened? Like somebody said that they're like, I'll allocate a few thousand dollars. Just come up with some scenarios. Just draw it out. Give me some plausibilities for because, of course, like with asteroids, the sooner you act, the easier it is to fix. And imagine, think about this. Elon Musk is right now the guy who's kind of running SpaceX and kind of, you know, kind of saving the electric car. He has that stuff in the hangar ready to go. Then
he is the one person on the planet right now who could order a launch, could get something on a pad, get it up and running, you know, by himself.
Yes.
And who could, I mean, like if he did it clandestine enough, right? Is there any, could anybody stop it? Like if he's like, hey, listen, you guys in Congress are dithering about whether or not we're going to blow up the asteroid that might, you know, destroy us in, you know, 20, 30 years or whatever. I'm sending the Elon Musk, like, you know, y'all heard about moonshots. My moonshots blow up the moon I'm shooting at. And that moon is that asteroid.
All right. Now,
I'm taking aim.
Think about this, though. Okay. So you got an asteroid coming. They're like, this is an extraordinarily close call. We've never had one that had an 80% chance of impact before. This is devastating. It's terrifying. The economy is collapsing. Elon Musk says, I'm going to fix it. And they've got time. They got like, you know, a few years or whatever. But he goes, does his thing, right? And then something breaks midway. When you have an asteroid coming, there's a few things you could do. You could do a gravity drive where you just kind of, you know, hover near it to kind of use your gravity to pull it. You have a mass drive where you get on it and you start flinging pieces of the rock off to sort of throw it off course. You know, of course, the sexiest is the whole, you know, blow something up on it, but you don't know what that's going to do. It's unpredictable. He tries one of those and it doesn't quite work. And the end result is that where they had, we'll say, a 60 to 80% chance of collision before, the mission ends, and now it's like, there is a 100% chance that this is going to slam right into the Earth. We need to prepare for the Dark Ages. All of a sudden, that same one man who made the call and who lifted the rocket, that one single individual is personally responsible for potentially destroying the human race.
Yeah, risk reward, Brian.
Yeah,
I like how you're dwelling on the dark side.
I'm just saying. Like, do you think everyone would sit by with that being a possibility?
Why do you hate private enterprise?
What? Wait, what?
Why do you hate private enterprise?
No, Jim. Come on, bro. I'm just saying, like, you're telling me, like, do you think anyone's going to let him? Like, oh, think about it. Okay, so imagine this.
I don't think he comes out and necessarily says, hey, guys, I'm going to do this. I think they would shut him down before he got a chance.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
But if, oh, man, do you think he just up and goes, or do you think he announces?
That's what I'm saying.
That's what we're talking about. Because if he says, hey, I got this, NASA's going to be like, no, you're not. FAA's going to be like, no, you're not. You know?
But next thing you know, he's in some unmarked room in, you know, a protectorate of the United States, so he can't put his finger on the button.
Oh, so you think they would totally stop him?
Dude, but for exactly that reason, you would have the president coming out and saying, or a spokesman for the world collection of world governments that would say, you can't have one man take. Yeah, you know, this is not vigilante space justice.
Okay, now, you know? But here's the thing. I feel like they would say that, but they would let them do it. I think they would stand idly by.
Take over the project. NASA and all that. Their engineers. They would want to, like, well, we need to do this. We need to look at this and check this out.
Okay, and yes, all of those things. They will say we need to check it out. No one man should have this right. You shouldn't do this. Stop what you're doing. But I think they stand there barking those things so they could be on the record as saying it, knowing that this guy's going to go up for free and waste his time and capital or whatever.
I think they seize the facilities. I think
they
pull in armed people there and take over the entire thing.
Because, Brian, that long storied history of the government just allowing people to do things completely unfettered without their control and oversight.
Oh, no. Look, there's a number of things that the government just barks and shouts like, you shouldn't do that. But knowing that it works out really well for them lets it happen. I mean, that's
letting a private individual launch his own ballistic missile.
I do not think would fall under that heading.
Well, I mean, isn't that what SpaceX is doing? I mean, what's the difference with,
They go to a NASA facility, they have an FAA-approved flight plan, they have NASA assist as far as the telemetry, everything else like there. It's cooperative. You're doing this with under the auspices of the government.
Well, let me flip this on you guys. You guys really think they could get away with a secret launch? How is that remotely possible?
Or some other place, they'd have to like, oh yeah, it's our new test pad.
Yeah, no, I don't think they're going to get away with that without anyone knowing. There's like politically, okay, if you have an imminent death threat upon you and it's more likely that it's good to do something than to do nothing, even if that something is reckless, what you do is you let that something happen, but all the time bark about the side crap that doesn't really matter.
You're the guy that just told us that what if it destroys all life on Earth?
Well, I mean, but again, like, what I mean, you know, what if?
So
like,
you're the I would imagine it'd play out where the president would bring in his science advisor and to ask him, like, what's the science advisor's like, well, we got to be in charge of this.
To go back to the original point, my point was not that, like, well, of course, he would just, like, in the same way that he would go out and buy illegal fireworks and light them off on the 4th of July, he'd be able to launch this ballistic missile to destroy an asteroid. It's just that if there were to be that person, he would be, and SpaceX would be, that operation, understanding all of the perils and the secrecy and the ridiculous, implausible nature that would go around doing something like that. There is only one man on the planet, and it is only because of his actions over the last 10 years that he has put himself in that position, that should that happen, theoretically, he would at least have the tools and the gumption to say, I'm Space Batman, and I'm destroying Space Joker, which is the asteroid that's going to destroy the Earth.
But I guess this is the part that weirds me out, is that you guys seem to think that the way he would do it would be to, in secret, develop a plan and launch without authorization.
No, that's the scenario. What if he wanted to do it that way? How cool would it be?
Yeah, I don't think that they would do that. I'm just saying that would be a thing.
Hey, I've got the technology. But we're thinking, like, what if he had a plan? What if he's saying, what if we had a government that saw this not as a threat, didn't know, or he was, I mean, if you had this power to avert world-ending cataclysm, would you say, hey, let's figure out how could we pull this off?
Uh, Okay. I don't necessarily understand the question, but I mean, I think that it would be a collaboration from the beginning and that everybody would want to put their, you know, smear their butts on it. So it had their stink on it.
Yes.
And then they could all take credit for personally saving the world.
How cool would it be if he just decided, let me have my backup plan of doing it on my own? That's the question. You don't have to say, yes, that's what's happening. It's just, that'd be kind of, it's a neat thing to think about. I would do that, but that's why I don't have SpaceX and responsibility.
Like, Brian, you know, like every once in a while, you'll see like news stories that are like the Pentagon's secret plan to invade China. And it's like these super, detailed, if crazy stuff happened, here is how we would, you know, here are the people that we would look to seize and here are the cities we would look to deploy troops in and here's how many people it would take. And it's like, yeah, because if you're the Pentagon and you're paying people, you know, you should be thinking about every possible contingency so we're never left with our pants down. What if, theoretically, Elon Musk, and again, bears repeating, SpaceX started as the concept of him putting a webcam in a greenhouse on Mars, like, because he wanted people to be fascinated by space and space exploration and Mars in general. So he is prone to completely outside-the-box thinking, like, with, like, the Hyperloop. What would it be if he, like, one weekend gets a wild hair up his butt because he reads this thing that like, well, you know, in the next 50 years, we might know if there's going to be an asteroid that would come near us. Like, what if he's like, well, not on my watch, bro. I'm the captain of the Milky Way's neighborhood watch. And I'm getting ready for the war if it goes off. And I'm going to just get my people together and see what would happen. Even if it was just, hey, we need to have everything set. So when we go to the government, we can say, like, all right, this is what we have in place. This is our contingency for when this happens. If he just got a wild hair about that.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, if the thesis is, does he have a plan? I bet money that he probably does. I bet that that's already done and not even a wild speculation. I totally would believe that they've run scenarios and come up with what it would cost, how fast they could do it, and in fact, probably includes what politicians they need to call and what wheels they need to grease to make it happen.
I think you brought up a great point, the cost. What if he has the plan and then he's a price tag? He calls to the president, I got this. They're like, oh, Mr. Musk, thank you so much. $1 trillion.
I mean, that's pretty much how that would go, right? You know, it's like it wouldn't be said that way. It would be said as, well, as you can understand, there's a sizable investment of my cost.
I don't think he's going to do 1,000% markup, but who knows?
I'd like to partner with the United States government for single-handedly just saving the world.
That would be like an awesome scenario. He's like, okay, what's the weight of the asteroid? How far is it? Okay, for option A, $2 billion.
What he would say is granted that we're saving the world, we'd like to participate in revenues moving forward. You're like, what does that mean?
And as is standard to all asteroid destruction schemes, we don't want to pay taxes ever.
And we don't want any liability.
Like, was that from Armageddon? And he's like, yes. He's like, okay.
Was that in Armageddon? I never finished
it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, by the way, that's the deal. That's the deal that those guys swing to go up and destroy an asteroid is they don't want to pay taxes ever, which is like almost the most like poetic and ridiculously awesome element of that movie is that it is so blue collar fantasy that it's like, that's the height. The height of we want to save the world is we don't want to pay taxes.
All right. Gentlemen, you ready for something else weird?
Ready.
Let's go.
I want you to give us a country that we're going to go to war with.
Estonia.
Estonia. All right. Estonia develops world-class military power. Estonia starts projecting its power around the world. You, Brian Brushwood. You, Justin Robert Young.
We had to watch out how bad we talk about Estonia, as this Estonian product Skype that we are talking on right now might immediately cut out.
Yeah, well, keep in mind also that the chat room being hosted in Estonia by our own T2T2. There's a reason I picked Estonia.
Fantastic. We go to war with Estonia, okay? Right? Maybe we're the bad guys, all right? Doesn't matter. Projecting their power around the world, you guys get drafted into the military. Like, you know what? You guys are very resourceful.
Man, Justin, I'm trying to figure out like what the military would want with me or Justin.
Unexplaining.
All right. All right.
Justin can blend in anywhere. He can look like anybody on any continent, any place.
He's the Brian, he's the chameleon of race.
Resourceful guy, right?
Okay.
Okay. I have faith in you. I believe in you. All right. I make you guys part of a crack team, right? But we send you into the wilds of Estonia, into the forests of Estonia, where there are important highways and roads going through there. And this is your operation. Sabotage. What I want you guys to do is to hide out in the woods, maybe destroy some roads, some bridges, maybe give you guys some sniper rifles. You see any Estonians, pop them.
Just pop one here, pop one there.
Military targets. First off, we need nicknames. I'm Mustache Pete and Brian's old white face.
Ghostface Killer.
There you go.
So you're behind the signs there. You guys now behind the signs, behind the lines there. You guys know how to survive. I mean,
there's signs on the line. So you were right both times.
You guys know how to survive. You know how to eat tree bark. You know how to live off the land, right? So now you're in there and you guys are waging your two-man war. In Estonia.
So our entire mission statement is to just tear junk up. Just
tear junk up, destroy opportunities, terror. So it spreads pretty soon. People are like, holy crap, there's something horrible off in the woods there. Don't go there. Military convoy routes decide to not take those roads. People are afraid to go around there. You're disrupting things there. You see Estonian troops, you shoot at them.
Do you think, Justin, that maybe to enhance things, we need to go the Scooby-Doo route? Like maybe start some legends?
Dress like girls?
No. Yes. No. Like start legends of like, I don't know, super intelligent Sasquatch that has a gun.
Oh, so we start rumors and then like where the old man withers at the amusement park.
That's what I'm saying. It turns out Brian and Justin just wanted to scare us off from the woods.
And we wouldn't have gotten away with it too if it weren't for you meddling Estonians.
So you guys are over there and you're pretty successful at it, right? But then your communications with like, you know, your commanding officers, your radio gets busted, whatever. You have no way to communicate with them, and you're deep behind enemy lines.
Right? Also too busy having fun. Huh? Did you see that semi I blew up?
So, like, and then you get, like, the Estonians are in a panic, so you're out there, and so the Estonians are like, you can come out now. It's all okay. Come on out now.
So they have us surrounded.
No. There's, like, some guy out
there. They're just shouting from outside the woods. They're all like, We like made peace with America, so everything's fine now. Come be our friend.
Come have this delicious Estonian buffet.
It's like whatever. They're gonna get a rock across their nose.
Right? Do you do
but
that?
Then at that cool. point, I mean, do we just live in the woods forever? Like, are we just wood hermits?
Until I mean, we tear. We
Is this the end for old Whiteface and Mustache Pete?
We were given one mission, Pete, and that is to tear stuff up, and that is what we'll do until we die or until Eisenhower rolls up and tells us we've done good.
You make like, a Estonians good are point, clever, man. OWF. They're clever. You know, they get some women coming out. They're like, "Hey guys, come on out. It's all good now. We're friends."
Yeah, I still don't believe it. No. I mean, it's like maybe, do they have other Americans? But they probably have fake Americans. They probably have people who like speak really good English.
They're like, hey guys, come on out. I got the newest Beach Boys record.
Have you guys been watching that hot new series on A&E? Don't Trust Andrew Main, Mondays at 10 p.m.?
Look at this. There's going to be new Star Wars movies. Phantom Menace.
Let's rock that Ace of Base, gentlemen, and dance the Macarena.
And then it's just them playing the Ace of Base album over and over and over again.
Dude, they're all taking bullets in the faces.
Find you.
So you're shooting them, and so you notice that like they tend not to come around as much.
Yeah, good. That means I've done my job. That means I own this territory. I'm here. This is my land.
So, like, you guys hold fast. So you're waiting for, at what point do you guys decide?
I mean, until all of a sudden, like, blue jeans start falling from the sky in parachutes, and we know that clearly America won, and we're showering our consumer goods all over these poor, benighted Estonians.
I mean, let me ask you this. So in this scenario, do we have any kind of fail-safe words, like, from the government? Like, is it one of those things that, since we're behind enemy lines, like, we would have to be given a certain kind of transmission to know that everything was okay?
Well, we had, like, a radio. The problem is this is a big, messy war, big, big, messy. And it's like, you literally rushed into an office, and I'm like, all right, guys, this is what you got to do. Here's your maps. Here's this, whatever. Good luck. And you're rushed out the door. And so here's your radio. Just use this to communicate.
So at that point, I mean, it seems like after waiting for a very long time that, you know, it would be in our interest to try and disguise ourselves and see what's going on.
So you're saying Whiteface maybe rubs some dirt on his face.
Yes.
Mustache Pete maybe gives a little trim.
Yeah,
and now
he's Hitler Joe.
Okay,
and as he's popular in Estonia, in war-torn Estonia at the time.
Here's the problem: is you guys really speak Estonian really well?
I bet the two of us could like fake sign language. Most of our signs are like that's, you know, just kind of.
So, Brian, I'm going to give you a hypothetical.
Yep.
What you imagine? Two dirty German guys in some region that's been having a lot of guerrilla warfare come out of the woods and start asking questions in World War II, you know, in England.
It's probably not going to go well.
Yeah.
We should probably just shoot everyone.
We're tourists. Yeah.
All right. Now I'm going to ask a controversial question. In this scenario, would it make sense to act mentally handicapped?
That's
like profoundly mentally handicapped.
That was.
Could you credibly act like a mentally handicapped Estonian as an American who knows none of the language?
You're in a region where they're terrorized by people. Everybody knows everybody, and you're going to be the stranger walking out of the woods.
Yeah, I don't think there's any way. Plus, also, I mean, I would imagine that an Estonian can like identify a non-Estonian. Like,
they have a huge tradition of guerrilla warfare themselves. The Estonian Forest Brothers was a group that was an anti-communist group in the Baltics that were like launching campaigns for years and years against the Russians and the Soviet power. So they know this.
So, I mean, and this is probably very real in that, like, this is what they did in what the Taliban did in Afghanistan, right? To send the Russians packing. What Osama bin Laden.
But this is
did.
Different. You're behind enemy lines.
Yeah, no, they had home court advantage.
That's true.
The Taliban.
So I guess we would be doing guerrilla warfare from behind enemy lines, which does complicate things. I guess the question is, how long do we go until, because you're right. Like, the problem is when you make that jump, you're not making the jump to do a little recon and learn stuff because we don't speak Estonian. We don't know what the words are. Pretty much, you're just going to, at some point, make the jump and, like, I'm pretty sure the war is over now. And it's like, I don't know that I would do that at any point.
Here's the thing. Like, you knew when the war would be over because you would see American flags everywhere. That's your assumption. The war was going to be over and you'd see American flags all around.
Yeah.
There's no way we're going to lose.
At that point, if the idea of reconnaissance is out and we have no solid way of waiting for definite American contact, then you got to figure we go out in a blaze of glory, right? You know, it's suicide packed old white face.
Man.
So the scenario
Hold on, Mustache Pete. I mean, it's like you're saying, you know, suicide time. We got food. We're just hanging out here. Why not keep hanging out? What's wrong with we're just here. Let's just.
You want to know what? Old white face. I agree. Smash cut. 2 years. The food's gone. Old white face. Remember that plan I had about suicide?
I saw a deer the other day. Maybe we can hunt a deer and then occasionally throw rocks at those Estonians. Why don't we do that?
So bringing this to a close. The scenario I played out actually happened, not in Estonia, but as you know, in the Philippines, Hiro Inada, who was a Japanese soldier sent behind the lines in the Philippines during World War II to do guerrilla warfare was the last holdout, was the guy that refused to surrender. The Philippines, the Philippine government's like, hey, war is over. He didn't believe it. They would get Japanese people to say, hey, war is over. Didn't believe it. This guy was there for 30 years. Finally, they had to get, I guess, his former commanding officer to show up and say,
wow,
no, really, it's over. And we're doing pretty good now. Don't worry. We didn't win, but we more than made up for it.
So, when was this? Like 30 years after the war?
1974 was when he finally surrendered. He went from World War II to 1974, 30 years in the Philippine jungle.
But it was known he was there during that 30 years, right?
They knew there was a guy there out there, terrorizing. They knew there was some guy there, but he just eluded capture.
Well, I guess the reason I'm asking is because the only reason I'm familiar with this idea, this construct that somebody would not know the war is over, is because I saw it in a Gilligan's Island episode.
That was based on him.
Yeah, okay, I figured that's the case, but I'm trying to line everything up. Like, had the guy surrendered by the time that episode came out?
There were other holdouts there too. That's the thing. Like, there were other people out there. I mean, it was not an uncommon thing.
It was a common story that there were people who weren't
Gilligan's
giving up.
Gilligan's Island came out like 10 years before this guy finally surrendered.
So, okay, so I guess by that point, even if there were, even if this last guy was still holding the line, it was still ripe for parody on Gilligan's Island.
Yeah, it was a common thing. They are very persistent people.
That's if you say what you will about the Japanese, they are very persistent.
Yes. Very,
attention to
very
detail.
Very dedicated. And so there you see the problem. When do you surrender? So Hiro Onoda, the last Japanese soldier to surrender, apparently, unless there's some other guy out there, he just died this week at 91.
Wow.
Afterwards, Dude. He became the celebrity because, like, 30 years, kind of the wound sort of healed. He went around, did a tour of the United States.
What?
Oh, they're like, yeah, because it's like, hey, look at this guy.
They're like, hey, remember when we hey, you know what was wild? I was reading some story about, I think it was like a minor item in a Cracked article that led me to a study that just went straight down a rabbit hole where, did you know that up until World War II, and including World War II, when they debriefed people after the fact and asked, how many times did you shoot at the enemy? What percentage of all the warriors do you think shot with the intent to kill the enemy?
I remember hearing some study that it was really low. It was like 20 or 30% or something. And then we redesigned our entire way of training people post-World War II, and that may have caused more problems.
15%. Yeah. 15% of people actually shot at the enemy. And in fact, oftentimes if a commanding officer is like, no, you have to kill them, turns out like it's really hard to intentionally kill another person. And so a lot of people would run materiel from point A to point B. They would help with stuff. They would run wherever they were told to run, but they just weren't so hot on actually shooting the enemy. And so it started a program that turned out to be, brutally effective in Korea and in Vietnam, where it was intentionally to dehumanize the enemy, the language change to, neutralize threats or whatever. And then it went up to like 90% or something ridiculous.
Yeah. I wonder how much of that also depends on like a volunteer admission versus a draft. Like if you are volunteering for the military, are you just that much closer to being able to make those decisions psychologically than just the wide swath of everybody in your population?
Well, if that was the case, then you would expect that the more draftees you would have, the less they would want to shoot. But it turns out that, you got Vietnam that had the draft. And so these are all people who don't want to be at war. But by this point, they got in the program figured out. And they made killers out of all those everyday Joes.
And more comedy on the Weird Things podcast.
So, time for one more?
Yeah. Hell yeah.
Mini one. You hear what happened to the Christ the Redeemer statue in Brazil, the big huge Christ statue standing on the mountain?
Yeah, it pulled a He-Man, Christ the Redeemer, up there saying, "By the power of Grayskull, I have the power." And then lightning struck him, made him look total badass, but then his fingers fell off. So it kept him from becoming He-Man.
Yeah, Barry gets struck a lot, but you know, that's what happens. But he's still there. This is cool. So over at I see this via Gawker.com, but I think it may have been, was it a Gawker IO9? They have a great, they did a really cool thing for Hey Science. And it was, are there still sea monsters? And so they did a query. They asked some experts to see, do you still think that there could be sea monsters lurking in the deep? And how likely is it there are large, say giant squid size or better, sea monsters have yet to be discovered? And they get some great quotes. Gustav Polly, curator of marine malacology at the Florida Museum of Natural History. He says there's a pretty good chance there's some large animals remain undiscovered. He talks about beaked whales, a group of cetaceans that's hard to encounter that keeps getting discovered. He says there's an undescribed beaked whale that is being eaten in the Kiribati Islands. So here's a mammal, even beaked mammal that we're finding, a whale, which could be, you know, porpoise size or bigger. He says that, you know, there are a few giant squids, could be some more giant squid out there. There could be large fish. He mentions the megamouth, which was just discovered a couple decades ago. Timothy Essington, professor of aquatic and fisheries science, University of Washington. It'd be interesting if you saw somebody who's like a professor of like, you know, ocean science, and it's like, you know, Utah or someplace where not a lot of access. I'm sure it could happen. He writes, he wouldn't be surprised if some intrepid explorer discovered some new bizarre form of sea life. He says it could be something enormous, radically new body design, or some unique way that it makes a living. And
I've got a question. Like, you know, mostly when we think of like what undiscovered sea monsters or critters out in the wild, like the first thing we go to is size, right? Because we want to be impressed by something so big and so elusive. And so, you know, like a giant squid, that kind of thing. But I wonder if that there exists life at a level that we just can't perceive it, either because the processes of it are so, you know, unfathomably slow that even though it's like, let's even make it a conscious entity, but it's just on another level, you know, like we're all mayflies and this thing's a freaking, you know, a sequoia, basically. Like there's no way a mayfly could ever perceive a sequoia as living.
Yeah, sure. I mean, in some scale, I think what I love about this question, though, is the idea that we're talking big stuff. Is there big stuff out there? And some of the examples, like we didn't know about the giant 6 foot tall tube worms on hydrothermal vents until 1977. You know, these things are huge in living in a very hostile environment. And you've got jellyfish, the pink meanie with 70 foot long tentacles. And just the idea that there are these really big sea monster type esque stuff to me is kind of awesome. You know, it's like, you know, the way we knew about giant squid is we would find their scars on sperm whales. You know, we'd from find battles? Their beaks inside of their stomachs.
Ugh.
And that's the ones that weren't good enough to get away from sperm whales. What's out there that can get away or can elude or maybe goes even deeper than they go?
Have you, I guess the implication there is, you know, if you want to get in an even more hostile environment and you want to get even bigger, like, has there been any talk about what a free range space based life form would look like? I mean, would it be like a giant whale that just kind of has a mass drive and an unfathomably long lifespan to sort of just jet around from area to area and soak up, maybe it photosynthesize as it goes? It just collects energy from the sun and derives its power from that.
I would imagine for something like that to potentially be viable, it needs to be in some sort of environment where there's a lot more material, there's a higher density of that. So, you know, maybe if we were to look through, you know, the rings of Saturn or.
Oh, no. Okay. No, that's all right. So picture some planet. You got, let's say, a gas giant with like crazy rings and a wide variety of stuff. There's water. Okay. Here we go. So imagine this green skinned gigantic beast that gets its energy from the sun by photosynthesis, but it needs water. That's what it hunts from place to place. So it's got to move its body to where the water is for the process to warm it up and everything. And so the way it propels itself, the way it gets around is that it grabs, I picture a bunch of arms, it just grabs rocks and just throws rocks to get from place to place to place, seeking more and more water. And then you're having to fight, I don't know, another dude at some point. Is that too weird? Is that idiotic talk?
I don't know. No,
guess,
Ryan.
I mean, that's the thing. I guess, like,
off the pod.
I thought this was a safe place, guys. I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, but like part of it is, you know, that's like, we can't figure out what's in our own oceans, you know, and like Andrew mentioned the idea, if you were to tell somebody we're doing the 1976 version of this podcast,
right,
you know, and you said, really weird. Well, listen, there's a 6 foot, but what if 6 foot worms lived on the vents at the bottom of the ocean? We would have the same reaction to you talking about your crazy space whale
that's true.
Floating through the rings of a far-flung planet. Like, we would have no idea. I mean, like, it stands to reason that things live in these insanely hostile environments. So maybe?
Why not?
Gentlemen, picks.
Oh man, I normally come prepared. I didn't even think ahead to picks. So I'll go late last.
Andrew, you got something?
Let me pull up.
You know what? Actually, I'll go. I'm gonna bunt here. Hey, you know what? Bonnie pointed out she didn't know whether to use the word bunt or punt, and I realized
guess
that
which game she's playing.
Well, yeah, but as far as the metaphor to not really try to score, but instead just do a little thing that progresses you, I guess the two could be used interchangeably, couldn't
they? No. Bunt. No. You'd want to use bunt, because bunt in baseball is just to take that minimal. In football, you always start with a punt.
Well, and a punt would be, I don't want to deal with this now. Let me push this down the road to deal with it later. That's what the metaphor for punt would be.
Okay, but like if you wanted to half-ass a thing, like you're like, well, it should be done this way, but I'm just gonna at least get some of it done.
If you aim to put forth a little effort to clear it from your ledger,
yeah,
it's a bunt. If you aim to put it off so you can deal with it with your full attention later, it's a punt.
Huh. All right. So which am I doing right now by saying I'm going to
if you're
going
offering
to
a crappy pick, you are bunting.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm going to reuse an old pick that we had talked about before, but I know we got new listeners and it came up in conversation recently. Somebody, you know, the organization, the Doomsday Clock, you know those guys?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're still at it. And weirdly, I really found that them an intimidating and important organization 30 years ago during the Cold War, when the threat of nuclear domination, and by the way, if you were born in 1990, screw you, because you don't know what real fear is like. You don't know when everything and was about, like, hey, by the way, we could all get nuked at any given moment. And that was the threat they were talking about when they said the Doomsday Clock. And as tensions would get higher, they would try to make it clear that you guys are about to ruin the world with your arguing and your nuclear bombs by moving the clock hand closer to midnight. The idea being at midnight where they're like, told you so. And then they fly off in their space boats. but the Cold War ended and the nuclear threat is, you know, it's not over. But I think it's safe to say that if we were at 3 minutes to midnight in 1984, the threat of global annihilation from nuclear war, we're like 6 months earlier than that now, as far as like the imminent threat goes. But these guys have rebranded, and now the Doomsday Clock is basically, as best I could tell, a full-scale nonstop scaremongering facility where it's like now it's global climate change and this and that, and just everybody. You know, it's all of a sudden, I just hate what they're doing. It's like, it's nothing but naked scaremongering that gets us nothing. So as a result, my pick is, and I got into a little bit of a scuffle with somebody on Twitter where they're saying, no, they're doing a really good job of bringing, you know, awareness to this threat. And I'm like, yeah, that was a threat. It's like, I would say things like, but the problem is we live in the most peaceful era in the entire history of mankind. Full stop. No argument. By light years.
Brian. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, exactly. and they're like, wait, how can you say that? And the answer is because I've read Steven Pinker's book, Better Angels of Our Nature, and it's utterly life-changing. When you hear what used to pass for entertainment 200 years ago, 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, it is difficult. it's difficult to even listen to the audiobook where he describes all this stuff. However, it is simultaneously unfathomably inspiring as you realize that by every objective measure, this is far and away the best time to ever be a human being in the history of the universe. You live the longest, you're the happiest, you're the healthiest. It's the most peaceful, most cooperative, most magical time in all of history. So if you want to feel inspired and also kind of disgusted by your great, 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 great grandfathers, then definitely pick up Steven Pinker's book.
I just gave that to somebody to read because, and I it's frustrating because, I encounter intelligent, well-educated people and you bring up, well, you know, we're better off, like, oh no, we're not. And it's like, okay, let's come up with objective ways that we can measure this, you know, and it's amazing how in education, how inculcated people can be into the world is broken. And yeah, it's been broken since it began. So are we, but we get better. And the idea though, that we're in this, that the perpetual belief that we're in a state of decline is, you know, every generation believes it from, you know, the Babylonians on forward, we're in a constant state of decline.
The guy, Dee Snider from Twisted Sister wrote a book like in the 80s and the opening page had a quote like, this generation is awful. They're prone to drink. They get nothing done. They just talk endlessly and they're listless. I fear for our future. And then it says like Cicero, 2000 yes. BC.
Yeah. we have that. And it's one of those things where you can say, well, this is a question we can answer with science. We can ask this question and come up with an answer that explains it. And it doesn't mean that there's not bad in the world. There's a lot of bad and a lot of personal things and people get affected by it. And it's just that weird to acknowledge that things are better. I've always been frustrated like you with the doomsday clock. It's scientists getting engaged in politics in a way that I don't think is helpful. And it brings down science to the level of ideology. And every time we do that, I don't think you solve problems. You just bring in all the problems of politics and make things worse. So I heartily agree with you. I think it's a great pick. And I'll get people like, no, it's not true. It's worse. Like, read this, get back to me.
Well, and again, it's like, there's what your gut tells you. There's it's funny because like over the last couple of years, I've read a bunch of books that sort of deconstruct the human mind. And, you read Daniel Kahneman's book, talking about, I forget the title of it, but the one where it's like, you got two brains working, system one, system two, and your intuitive gut is basically what kept you alive, in the old days, but is really just kind of a pain in the ass and dumb nowadays, but it's who's driving most of the time when you work. And so as a result, like I constantly question things that I assume about everything at all times. And once you start doing that, like, well, what if what's obvious isn't true? And what if we're all flawed wetware that can't see the world correctly by nature? Then you can open your mind up to be like, well, let's look at surveys of leisure time and notice that, you know, that there's more leisure time than ever before. Let's look at the fact that IQ scores have to be reformatted because they go up 1 point every 10 years. It's an amazing, I had this thought today or yesterday. YouTube is far and away, light years better, greater than the Library of Alexandria. Like YouTube is the sum total of human knowledge, put in video form for explanations.
I would maybe use Wikipedia as my example of that.
No, I would say YouTube specifically. I just think the volume.
I would have trouble knowing what are facts and finding them in YouTube.
You can't learn to dance very well from Wikipedia. You can't learn to change a carburetor very well from Wikipedia.
If I wanted to find out like certain, I would just say its ability. How
there's a reason that Khan Academy doesn't use Wikipedia articles to teach people; it uses YouTube videos
selected by people from Khan. That's what I'm saying. There's a selection process that makes Khan Academy fantastic. I'm saying that if you just gave me YouTube and said find this, I can name a number of topics that I'm going to get very well ill informed about because there's not the same sort of process that we use in other things of, you know, how do we figure out, you know, what's more like, I think the content is there. Right. I'm trying to think like, how would I,
you're talking about the filtering problem.
Yeah. And we know the examples that, yeah, I mean, Wikipedia is not like the be all, but I'm like, Khan Academy, like, love it. It's great. And you can find those things there, but I can think of a lot of like paranormal stuff, things like that, where you could be you hit the wrong tangent. You're torn. And again, not to devalue it
that's,
all.
That's true. However, in my defense, my guess is there are some crappy books in the Library of Alexandria as well.
Oh, for sure. For sure. But I would hope that, you know, Hypatia or whatever who organized it would probably say, okay, we're going to put this over in the paranormal because it doesn't meet these criteria. I don't know. Again, but I think I'm not going to devalue that at all. I love it.
I mean, my point is that
last week was the crappiest books in the Library of Alexandria that will haunt your dreams.
I guess my point is that, you know, YouTube has a reputation of being cat videos, but like secretly YouTube has some of the most important educational content
Absolutely.
That you're ever going to run across.
Absolutely. And that excites without a doubt. I totally support your statement there, sir. I have a pick.
Go.
Up.
The movie?
Just watched it again. Just love that movie. Just love so good. Up. It's such a fun movie.
Question. Is the fact that Monsters University was not nominated for a Best Animated Feature Oscar the Academy members punishing Pixar for doing sequels?
Because
that movie was good. I really liked it. I thought it was, and it was certainly better than Cars 2 and some of the other stuff that, you know, I would rank it ahead of some other stuff that Pixar has gotten nominated for, but it just... it's an interesting question if maybe there is backlash to Pixar doing sequels.
I've only half seen it in that, like I've seen bits and pieces and I've listened to the entire thing as the kids watch it in the back of the car. So it's, I can't really speak to that. I don't know if it's that, if I can't answer. I don't know.
I watched the, of the nominated feature films. I only saw Frozen and, but you know, Despicable Me 2 got nominated. So I don't know how much of a sequel prejudice there is then if they did that.
Yeah, I guess if it would be if they want and expect better of Pixar, and they want to punish Pixar.
You think they're being held to the unfair trend. The Pixar standard unfairly?
Yeah, I mean, I don't. Again, I have only seen of the nominees. I only saw Frozen, which I really enjoyed. I like Monsters University more than Frozen, which I enjoyed Frozen, but I like Monsters University more. I do think that, you know, it is like you watch, you know, the poignant Toy Story 3 and then, you know, Monsters University, just a more fun follow-up. So maybe.
But Up.
Yeah. So that's just my pick. I just go back, watch it. You know, it's one of those things where those first 10 minutes
was, oh dude, where like the robot test where basically in the first 10 minutes, it finds out whether or not you're a human being by yeah. making you cry.
Yeah, to get you so engaged and so pulled into those characters so quickly, so readily, it's just an amazing sort of well done story.
Was there anything that you caught the second time watching it that you missed the first time?
I guess not that I noticed.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny because Up is really, you know, I think we would all agree it kind of goes into the masterworks of Pixar and, you know, a greater among equals in terms of their best work, because it has, I mean, for a movie that deals with fairly mature themes like aging and dying and loss and regret and stuff like that, to wrap that up in a movie that has kids movie beats, like there still are, you're never really far away from a laugh. You're never far away from a big physical action moment. Like it really is a work of art. I mean, Up is just the rarest of all birds when it comes to stuff like that, even for Pixar.
Well, and keep in mind, like Up and Wall-E, I think we're back to back, right? And both of them were extremely just heavy. Like one dealing with the nature of growing old and dying and never quite realizing your dreams. The other with the fact that all of humanity eventually is going to chew up and spit out the husk of planet Earth that we're going to go off. Do those movies have, I would be really curious about the replayability of them. Like I don't see a lot of Up merchandise and I see maybe a tiny bit of Wall-E merchandise. It's just as much as I value the artistic decisions to explore those worlds and to give that kind of texture, like my kids don't beg me to put that back on. You know, they want to go watch the stuff that's fun to watch again and again and again.
We know that like with the number one or the number two brand and children's merchandise is Cars.
Cars, yeah.
That's why there will always be Cars movies. We will all die while Cars-related feature films are being produced with a Larry the Cable Guy voice impressionist doing Mater.
I actually, I liked Cars. And yes, it was Doc Hollywood. Yes, it was a familiar song, but it was exquisitely performed. It was, I mean, they're just masters of doing that stuff. I didn't see Cars 2, though, which I heard was a hot mess.
I liked Cars. I didn't love Cars. Cars 2 is not a good movie. Like, it's just, it's simply, and it has weird, especially for Pixar, kind of decisions on, like, there's like a lot of gunplay. There's like a lot of gun violence.
There's like a torture scene in there, right?
There's a torture scene. There's like pee jokes and stuff that don't usually make their way into Pixar movies. It was just odd to see.
Justin, do you have a pick?
I'm going to go ahead and shout out a friend of this show, and hopefully we'll have him on in the next couple of weeks. But Scott Sigler, our friend, science fiction author, has got a brand new book out called Pandemic. You can go ahead and pre-order it now at scottsigler.com. He's doing a big book tour. So if you dig on Sigler, and really who doesn't, go on over there and see if he's coming to a town near you. But I believe he's going through Boston, New York, Washington, D.C., Baltimore, and then back to the West Coast. So go ahead and check it out. And if you want to see us having fun with them on NSFW show, download the latest episode of NSFW show with me and Brian. I believe it's called Nine Fangs of My Aunt.
The Nine Fangs of My Aunt. Yeah. And I'll tell you what, I'm glad you reminded me, because just today I was listening to a podcast. I got all caught up on my podcast. I was like, I got to start an audiobook, and I didn't know what I was going to start. But now I'm going to start that whole trilogy since it's on Audible.
Yeah, we're going to try to see if Scott's available to come in here and maybe do a pandemic-themed Weird Things.
Yeah.
No, I think that would be great. He's been, of course, been on the show before, and we will be excited to have him back on again. And I think, I believe it's Infected. Contagion, I think, is the middle one, and then Pandemic.
Yes. Infected, The Sneezing, I believe, is the second one.
But go ahead and check it out, scottsigler.com.
Very good. Well, gentlemen, it's been weird.